Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Angharad Carrick. And coming up, the mystery of the stolen Nectar points. Why hasn't the issue been fixed? Does it matter if your mortgage runs after retirement? I'm 77, still working and worth 2.6 million. Have I left it too late to cut my inheritance tax bill? And would you buy cash off social media for a knockdown price? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, loyalty programs. Love them or hate them. You most likely have at least one kind. And if you don't want to pay over the odds at, say, supermarkets, they are increasingly hard to ignore. Just ask our Simon Lambert, who recently succumbed to a Sainsbury's Nectar card. But apart from all the data that companies can glean from you when you sign up to these programs, there is another dark side to them. Fraudsters. Ang has been looking into the mystery of the stolen Nectar points. Ang, welcome. Simon, welcome. Ang, to you first, though. As this is your story, you've been looking into this. What's it all about? But before you go into the specifics, just explain to us Nectar cards before Simon takes over and gets really grumpy because he really didn't want to have to do it, but he had to in the end. Why?
Yeah, so, I mean, like any loyalty card, you kind of collect points for however much you spend. I think with Nectar, it's 1 point for every £1 qualifying spend. So I think it excludes certain things like alcohol, tobacco, that sort of thing. And then also a point each litre of fuel in Sainsbury's fuel stations.
But you can also convert them to Avios points. I do that automatically, yeah. But Sainsbury's, I mean, it's not the most generous. I feel like when you buy, it's like you have to spend about £800 million before you get, you know, a packet of biscuits for free.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, each point is worth 0.5p. So you need to spend, I think, £200 to save up £1. I mean, it takes a while. I don't think I've ever kind of been able to successfully save up a lot and kind of get a chunk out of my kind of weekly shop. But I think a lot of our readers do. And one reader got in touch this week saying that she'd amassed 44,000 Nectar points over the course of about 12 to 18 months.
How much is that worth, financially speaking?
About £230.
Wow, that is an effort.
Yeah, yeah. And I think quite a lot of people do it. They kind of save them up over a long period of time and then a large shop at Christmas or you know, going on holiday or whatever it is. So when she received an email saying that all of those points had been spent, she was slightly shocked. They had been spent in a store, a Sainsbury's store in Fallowfield in Manchester. She lives in Cheshire and had not been to that store. So it obviously wasn't her. So she got in touch with Sainsbury's to ask what had happened. They immediately refunded her, said it was fraudulent. And then a few weeks later, she was told by the fraud team that actually it wasn't fraudulent. So the points were removed again. Rather than looking into it, as we'll probably talk about that, you know, there is widespread fraud when it comes to Nectar points. She was just directed to her local police station.
Can you imagine going to your police and saying, hello, I'm really sorry to bother you, but my Nectar points have been stolen? They'd laugh in your face, wouldn't they? And rightly
exactly. And I'm not sure it's, I mean, what we wrote about this earlier in the year as well, a similar kind of story about a man who'd lost similar amount and was told to go to the police. And he got in touch with Action Fraud, and Action Fraud said, this isn't a police recordable crime. So you've kind of got a situation where neither party really wants to take any responsibility for it. I mean, the points have all been refunded, so it's kind of Sainsbury's that are losing out here. So no one's quite sure who needs to kind of record it. I don't think the police have really the time or, frankly, the kind of
will
resources or will exactly to deal with this. I think they have a bigger issues at the moment, not least kind of shoplifting in these stores.
I mean, it should be pretty obvious for Sainsbury's now to work out who spent the points and how, because I mean, I don't know, but every time I go into a shop now, I feel like I'm looking at myself on a screen. Surely they keep that, and you can tell immediately when the time it's been spent and therefore who spent it. And now I don't know what they do, because I mean, let's be honest. Yes, it's points, and you think, okay, there's 230 quid. That's a bit. It's a bit annoying, but these things hold so much data about us. No.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can track. I think quite often Sainsbury's know when it's been a fraudulent purchase because they look back and go, hang on, you've never bought, I don't know, a certain type of nappy brand or a certain type of beans or something like that. And they can go, okay, actually, we can see. So you'd think that if there was a kind of, you know, someone suddenly spending thousands and thousands of points in a store that is nowhere near this person's home, that there would be some kind of system in place to kind of alert them to it. Clearly not. And I think, you know, we've obviously asked Sainsbury's what's happening. They're not going to tell us the details. There are obviously theories. I think the thing that is the issue, and it happened to Lee, is that he didn't lose his card, but someone was using the points. And this seems to kind of happen across the board with the people that I've spoken to, is that they still have their card. It's not like they've lost their wallet. It's someone using this Nectar barcode and scanning it somehow. I mean, surely there must be some kind of security system in place. This has been going on for over 10 years, but I don't know, maybe it's too expensive for them to completely overhaul the system, or they just can't be bothered. I mean, when we asked them, they said it was a tiny proportion of their 18 million customers, but 0.1% of that is 18,000 people. It's a lot of people. A lot of people.
Simon, your views as a new fresh Nectar card holder?
Sadly, it's not that new, my Nectar card adventure. It dates back a number of months now. I think it might
be this
year.
That counts as new, Simon.
Yeah, well, I capitulated. I believe that life is too short for loyalty cards, which is a stupid statement. I've been pulled up on it repeatedly, but life is too short for loyalty cards. However, life is not too short to avoid being robbed at the till, because someone has created a two-tier pricing scheme to try and force you to get said loyalty card. And if you do shop in Sainsbury's regularly, which I do, I shop in other supermarkets regularly too, but if you do shop in Sainsbury's regularly, then you will not have failed to notice the colossal difference in the prices on some things, depending on whether you get Nectar prices or not. And Sainsbury's and Tesco are both up to this ruse. And it means that it really does pay off to have one of these cards and to scan them. So to tell a little story, I picked something up in Sainsbury's the other week. It was a big bag of crisps, right? Roast chicken flavour, I believe. It's like, ooh, I might get £1 rather than £1.50. Oh, I fancy. So I haven't had some of those in ages. Quite fancy those. Took them in my shopping to the till with my youngest daughter. We paid for the stuff. I walked out. Oh, I didn't scan the Nectar card. I was really quite cross. Damn it. My daughter said, what? I said, I didn't scan the Nectar card. I've been robbed for the crisps. She was like, what do you mean you've been robbed? I was like, I paid £1.50 for them. She said, well, how much would they have been? I said, £1. She said, but that's 50p, Dad. Are you sure it's worth that getting that cross about? I was like, that's a third of the price. And in fact, I've paid 50% more, giving her a short lesson in percentages as we were walking down the street. And it's really quite galling. But on other things, it's even more expensive. I mean, it's things like joints of pork to roast, a pork roasting joint. The difference in price can be like £2, £2 or £3. It's completely mad. But it is forcing people like me to get an X card, and then Sainsbury's can track our spending and start spamming us with offers and things like that. And it's the same with club card. I have a club card because we get most of our shopping from Tesco. And the reason for that is because when we lived in London, the supermarket around the corner was a Tesco. And also my wife used to work for Tesco. So she had a club card through work. And so, but on our online shop, it obviously automatically comes off. But I've now got a copy of that club card on my phone so that when I go to the till, I can use it. And we've heard stories of people at the till borrowing other people's Nectar cards or club cards in order to just make sure that they get the lower prices because they've got no interest in the points. I have no interest in the points, to be honest. Although actually, the club card points I've learned to understand in recent years can be quite handy.
Mm.
I have no interest in the points. I only have the interest in getting the money off so that I pay a fair price. And both Tesco and Sainsbury's are under investigation by the CMA at the moment over this two-tier pricing and other people indulging in this. The Co-op does it a bit, but nowhere near as bad because the gap between these costs is really, really quite substantial. And consumer champions such as ourselves are not overly happy with that. But back to the points thing, I discovered a couple of years back, belatedly, unfortunately, because the multiplier has now got not as good, that you can use club card points to pay for Eurotunnel tickets, or Le Shuttle, as it's now known.
Oh, okay.
And they double up. So what your club card points are worth 1x, if you spend them on your Tesco shop to get money off, they're actually worth 2x if you use them against the Eurotunnel or various other things. There's loads of different things you can do. It's like they're called reward partners or something. If you have club card points or Next points, do look it up because actually it can save you a fair bit if you've been accumulating them. And because we do our weekly shop with Tesco, we've accumulated loads of these points. And my wife said that every so often she'd just like spend them on the shop or whatever. But we've stopped doing that now and we use them to get some money off Le Shuttle or Eurotunnel, as it's known in old language.
Very good, Simon. Very good. So at least you're making the most of these things. But long-term listeners to the show will remember, and I've referenced this often, is Simon's point about life is too short for loyalty cards first came about, I think it was 2018, and I got out my wallet. I turned it upside down, and there was an audible clatter of all the cards that came dropping out. I was a fan back then, or at least an enthusiast. I don't know whether I enjoyed them that much. But now, Ang, they just, like Simon says, it drives me mad. I feel like I'm being slightly duped. I can never remember. Some of them are on my phone, and then it takes ages to get it up on the phone and scan it in the shop. And I'm fed up with them. I feel like they're scrambling around trying to find ways. Why don't they just focus on the two things that we care about? Low prices and great customer service.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the supermarket thing is infuriating, not least because the data point, you know, we don't know what we're handing over. And I think that this points fraud really kind of hammers at home that, you know, you should be able to trust these companies. The thing that bothers me more than anything, though, beyond the supermarkets, which, I mean, we've had the loyalty cards for a long time, it's things like Superdrug and Boots. And, you know, those products are really, really expensive. And suddenly we've got almost like a 50% markup if you don't have a loyalty card for Boots. And out of principle, I haven't got one, but I feel like I am spending a lot of money in there. And I'm probably going to go the way of Simon and just suck it up and get a loyalty card.
I just think Boots points are good. Like Next points are rubbish. But Boots points are actually quite good. I would say like Boots is probably the best sort of loyalty card out there. But then I'm probably paying more anyway just to go to Boots. So I don't know. But future, can we be done with these loyalty cards? Or is it only just going to get more personalized, specific, inevitable?
I think it will probably depend on what the CMA says about this two-tier pricing, because that's kind of, I think people were probably not that fussed about loyalty points before maybe the cost of living crisis is when it all kind of came to the fore, because you know it is unfair that you have to have so many cards in your wallet, make sure that you bring it out, and just to get, you know, a normal price for a standard product, a loaf of bread or a pint of milk. And I think more people are wondering, you know, as you say, Boots, the Boots points might be great, but I've got an M&S Sparks card. I scan it every time. I don't really get any points. Not sure why I have it. But maybe we've just now got to a point where it's, you know, it's pretty standard. It's just part of the kind of going to the shop, scanning your loyalty card and spending loads of money.
Simon?
I am so inept at using loyalty cards that I have a Waitrose card, and my Waitrose card, which I got because if you have a my Waitrose card, there's something whereby, like, I think you can get meat off the butcher's counter cheaper on a Friday or something mad like that. I can't remember what it was, right? It was like 20% off. It was like really, like quite a lot of money off some steak. But I'm so inept at these things that I didn't realize that it was giving me personalized offers in the app and that I could claim the offers until there was a story about how Waitrose had downgraded the personalized offers. So I was like, what are these personalized offers? And then it was explained to me what they were. And I was like, oh, I did wonder what the benefit of this card was, other than randomly occasionally getting some money off something. Mm-hmm. I've got personalized offers that I can spend on. Ah, I also keep doing the most middle class thing ever. And I have got a Waterstones card. Waterstones cards quite good, right? Mm. If you spend £100, you get £10 off next time. Again, for years, no. If you've got a Waterstones card, no, don't want one. If you've got a Waterstones card, no, don't want one. If you've got Waterstones, no. Until one of the really nice people in the shop said to me, you know, you're spending £40. Yes. Do you spend money in Waterstones regularly? I was like, yeah, probably reasonably regularly. And they were like, okay, you should get a Waterstones card because every time you spend £100, you get £10 off. I was like, nah. Oh, hang on a minute.
It's so true.
That's quite good. And she said to me, like, you know, if you do this another two times, you just get a tenner. I was like, yeah, I could see how I'd do that. So I've got a Waterstones card. Always used to have to open the app. Used to drive me mad. Added it to my Apple Wallet. I now keep trying to accidentally scan my Waitrose card in Waterstones. Most middle class thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, that's a given, though. I just keep thinking every time I go through the tube, I'm using my Boots card or something, some other random card that I've just picked out. All right, we're going to leave loyalty points and cards to one side. Aang, I assume if anyone has any other issues with Nectar or any other loyalty cards, they can get in contact.
Yeah, absolutely. If you just email editor@thisismoney.co.uk with Nectar or loyalty points in the subject line, and I will try and get back to you.
Marvellous. Right. This week, it was revealed that over the last 3 years, 1 million people have taken out mortgages which run beyond the current state pension age of 66. Now, the new data from the Bank of England shows how large numbers of buyers are gambling with their retirement prospects by taking on ultra-long mortgages. That's the concern of former pensions minister and This Is Money agony uncle, Sir Steve Webb. But what's the problem with ultra-long mortgages? Simon, firstly, what are they? What does the new data show? Are you as concerned as Sir Steve?
I do genuinely think that this is a problem, and I will explain why I think this is a problem. On the surface, it doesn't really look like it matters that much, to be honest. People are working longer. Lots more people are working beyond the age of retirement anyway, or doing some work. Pensions are much more flexible now than they used to be. The state pension age is currently 66. If you're taking out a mortgage now as a first-time buyer, your state pension age is not going to be 66. Very unlikely. My state pension age, and bearing in mind I'm 45, is 68 currently. And I'm mildly concerned that it ain't going to be 68 by the time I get to 68. There is lots of talk of raising the state pension age. One of the great things about the triple lock is that it has pushed up the pensions that people get in this country, and people now get a much better pension than they did. The problem is that the people who are still working are paying for it, and it's an unsustainable situation because we keep refusing to actually tackle the underlying problem, whilst continuing to make problems about meeting the triple lock. And so the burden on those who are working is getting greater, And ultimately, what's going to happen is that going to get shoved into higher state pension age. And you're seeing a scenario where the state pension age moved up due to longevity extending, but now the state pension age might start moving up due to the fact that we just can't afford the it gets described as a pyramid scheme, but it's not really a pyramid scheme. It's just an ongoing system where the people at the bottom pay the money to the people at the top. And as long as you've still got people coming in at the bottom, it's fine. Which I know does sound like a pyramid scheme. But if you are taking out a mortgage and it is running into your state pension age, the issue is that past retirement, your income is going to likely to fall compared to your working income. And ideally, you want to have your outgoings being as low as possible so that your pension income is covering everything that you need. And if you look at the PLSA figures for the cost of a basic, moderate, comfortable retirement, those actually exclude two important things. One, tax, but also two, housing costs. And we are going to have a growing number of people who face still having housing costs in terms of either rent or mortgage once they reach state pension age. And to put that into context, you could be paying, you know, looking at like average mortgages at the moment, you could be paying like £1,500 a month on your mortgage. And £1,500 a month on your mortgage is going to be 18 grand a year. And that's 18 grand a year out of your now limited income. And your state pension isn't going to cover the 18 grand. And then you've got to get all your other pension income to cover it. So this is where the concern comes from. But what's happening here is that people are being squeezed into this by affordability-based lending. And what happens is when you apply for your mortgage, your bank, your building society, they all do an affordability-based calculation based on your incomings and your outgoings. They have slightly different models, but they all basically do pretty much the same thing. And they say, our model shows you can afford £1,400 a month. But it might be that in order to get the property that you want, you need to borrow more money than that. And it's going to cost you £1,500 a month. But they're saying you can't have a mortgage that equates to £1,500 a month because you can't afford that. You can have one £1,400. But what you can do is if you extend the life of the mortgage, so you pay it back over 35 years instead of 25 years, that'll get you to meet the 1400 box ticked, you can have the mortgage. This is running into people's retirement ages. People are asked, when are you going to retire? And then they give an answer. People are quite possibly lying about when they think they're going to retire in order to get the mortgage. When do you think you'll retire? Oh, 70. In their mind, they're thinking, I'm not retiring at 70. I'm retiring at 60, but I need this mortgage. Okay. It just happens, you know. And people may have ambitions or may have life changes that means that they can't keep working until they're 70. But the bigger issue here is that how much extra money this is costing people. Because if you borrow your mortgage over 35 years rather than 25 years, you are going to end up paying back a hell of a lot more in terms of interest. So the ultimate winners here are the banks. Also, the ultimate winners here are anybody who thinks high house prices is a good idea, because by doing this, we're just effectively keeping the whole high house price thing propped up by continuing to lend people more money. And there is a solution to this, though. And the solution to this is that, okay, you take your longer mortgage to get your mortgage because you need your mortgage, you want your mortgage, you want to be able to buy that property, because in many cases, people are spending more money on rent than they would be on the mortgage anyway. So they're just like, if I can just get that mortgage and get that property, then at least I own that property and I'm not just handing the money over to my landlord and I'm paying this landlord £500 or £600 a month more than the mortgage would be anyway. But then what you do is you try to overpay the mortgage. So if you think, actually, do you know what? I could have stretched to 1500 quid, whatever the bank says, you know, it's only an extra £100 a month. Don't just get the 1400 quid option with the longer term and then just spend the rest of the money. Take the extra £100 and every single month overpay that mortgage, because then when it comes time to remortgage, potentially you take out a 5-year fix. In 5 years' time, you'll have overpaid enough of the mortgage that you can then reduce the term and you then go on to the shorter term mortgage. The big danger for people who are taking longer term mortgages is they never reduce those terms. Mm. So if you can overpay the mortgage, then that will really make a big difference. And actually only a relatively small amount of money, if you do it every single month, can make quite a big difference.
Does there need to be more regulation specifically around this, do you think, Simon? Because, you know, I thought, like you mentioned there about the affordability test, the mortgage market review. I mean, surely this should be covered in that. They need to take into consideration whether you're likely to pay off.
I think it's the kind of rule of unintended consequences, isn't it? You know, because it's well-meaning. It's been put in place for a reason. These are affordability-based lending in response to the financial crisis, in response to, you know, banks and building societies racing to lend each other ever greater multiples, you know, promoting mortgages on the basis that we'll lend you 5 times your salary, we'll lend you 6 times your salary. But the problem is that it has become increasingly expensive for people. And if you look at, you know, a mortgage, so say you take out a £200,000 mortgage and you end up paying an average interest rate of 4% over the lifetime of that whole mortgage, right? If you take it out over 25 years, then your monthly payments would be £1,055. If you take it out for 35 years, your monthly payments will be £885. So you're much more likely to meet those affordability-based lending criteria. But the total amount that you will pay in interest on the longer mortgage is £172,000, whereas the total amount in interest you will pay on the 25-year mortgage is £117,000. So that is a £54,000 difference.
Oof.
It's actually £55,000 difference. Sorry, I did the maths as I was talking to you then in my head. But that's quite a big difference, you know, in terms of the interest you're paying. In fact, you're paying nearly 50% more interest.
Wow.
Than you would have done otherwise. And, you know, maybe what we should have done is said, okay, we're going to do affordability-based lending, but you can't just keep extending the terms of mortgages to squeeze people into it. But I think the problem is we're trying to shut the stable door after the horse has bolted now. So what do you do about all the people who've already taken the longer mortgages? What do you do about all the people who are going to go, well, hang on a minute, I want a longer mortgage because I want a mortgage. And you've just let all those people get mortgages on the basis of getting longer mortgages. And now you're telling me that I can't have one. Mm. And frankly, I'm paying my landlord £500 a month more in rent than this anyway.
Isn't it just, Ang, are you a homeowner?
Sadly not, and probably won't ever be at this point.
Tempted by long term?
Do you know, I was thinking about this and I do wonder if lots of people kind of view it almost like the student loan, where it's like, oh, well, you know, it's too expensive anyway, so like what's an extra kind of 10 years. And as Simon says, I mean, £1,500 on a mortgage, that, I mean, that's less than my rent at the moment. I'd be quite happy. I think I'd prefer to maybe have a longer mortgage, that it means that I'm not renting into my kind of 80s, which but I imagine a lot of people is kind of a reality, because if they can't get on the housing ladder, you know, what other option do they have sort of beyond inheriting? It doesn't seem like there's really that many other options for kind of first time buyers that, you know, can't save for a deposit, especially in London. So, yeah, it's kind of really long mortgage and potentially having to pay a mortgage in my 70s. Or renting, neither are great options.
No, quite. You've highlighted though something, this is a bit off topic, but you've highlighted something that actually quite bugs me about the student loan system and how much students have to pay at the moment. It's the mindset that if you are starting your adult life that much in debt, what does that make you think? How does that make you consider debt as you go through your life? So it's interesting you said there, oh, what's the extra 50% of interest that I will have to pay because I'm already paying loads anyway? So you've beautifully summed up a point there that I've been trying to make for many a year, Simon.
And yeah, and just to put the maths in context, just to give you another figure, okay, talking about that £1,500 a month thing, right? So Ang was saying, I'd love £1,500 a month. That'd be great. The difference between what you can get for your £1,500 a month, and this is actually the way that this works, is like, what can you get for your £1,500 a month? If you can get a mortgage at 4.5%, which is a decent rate at the moment, okay, for £1,500 a month over 25 years, you could get £270,000. For £1,500 over 40 years, you could get £340,000. So that's a £70,000 difference. And for a lot of people, That is literally the difference between being able to buy a home and not being able to buy a home. And that's why people are taking 40-year mortgages.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, welcome to the podcast. Over the past month, the FTSE 100 has been hitting record highs. In fact, it has notched up 12 record closes in 1 month, which matches a record that dates back to 1984. Rob, why has the FTSE 100 been hitting so many highs over the past month?
I think there's a few reasons. So firstly, it was cheap to start with, both versus other markets and its own history. It's really lagged a long way behind the US market in particular, really for the best part of a decade. So it's kind of due its moment. But people have been saying it's good value for some time, but it hasn't been able to sort of achieve new highs. What it really lacked, I think, was a catalyst to break through some prevailing negative sentiment and reverse the flows out of UK assets that have been depressing share prices and holding the FTSE back. And gradually that's turned, and helpfully the performance of the UK economy has perked up to the surprise of some commentators. It's still not great perhaps, but it's definitely significantly better than a lot of people feared. And when things seem very negative, a bit of good news does go a long way, and that's really helped boost investor sentiment towards the UK as a whole. And at a company level, there's been some positive trends as well. So the big international earners in the FTSE 100 have benefited from strength in the US dollar, which has increased their earnings when measured in pounds, and overall company results have been pleasing. Some of the UK's big sector constituents, such as energy and mining, as well as defence, have been doing well. And meanwhile, we've had the green shoots of merger and acquisition activity. And that's where a company or investor approaches another company to buy it and typically offers a premium over the prevailing share price. And the cheapness of UK shares has ushered in a series of these approaches, which creates a halo effect across the market, not just in the target business itself. So this all adds to the feel-good effect, highlighting to investors the cheapness of the UK market and perhaps reinvigorating the interests of investors that had previously dismissed it.
So as an investor, if I want to invest in the UK stock market, is a FTSE 100 tracker a good option?
So a FTSE 100 fund or ETF will give you exposure to the UK market as a whole, though it is quite narrow and biased to certain areas such as energy, pharmaceuticals, financials, and things like that. So when you buy the FTSE 100, you're really buying those big, mostly international firms. There's nothing wrong with that. They tend to be decent, big companies with attractive dividends. And the FTSE All Share, that's a bit wider. So you could have a tracker covering that. But again, it's still weighted towards these largest companies in what's got a top-heavy market. So there is something to be said for having broader exposure than that and actually looking at more medium-sized and smaller firms, and they tend to be a bit more exposed to the domestic economy typically, but it is perhaps where valuations are more depressed and there's more of a chance of that beneficial merger and acquisition activity happening. So there is a good argument for pairing one of the traditional tracker funds, for instance, with something with greater breadth that includes more smaller and medium-sized businesses, and that way you capture a wider variety of opportunities in your investment.
Well, let's hope that market keeps going up. Thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Reader question time. I'll keep it brief because it's a long email. I'm 77, still working. Good on you. And worth £2.6 million. Also, good on you. The question though, Simon, how can your reader cut their inheritance tax? Is it too late? Go. That is good. 77, isn't it? It's like my dad. 74, still working.
Marvelous. My mum's 75 and she still works. Marvelous. She runs her own business. I like to hope that our generation will see things through the same eyes, you know. But what our generation probably won't see is the fact that they've made so much money in house price, in house price inflation, that they're in the position of our reader who wrote in. And basically the reason why they're worth £2.6 million is because they've worked really hard, but also because they have a house worth £1.8 million, which is mortgage free. And they probably bought that house for like $100,000 or something. I'm making this up, but there is an entirely plausible scenario where somebody is now sitting on a £1.8 million house in London or the southeast of the country, and they paid a couple of $100,000 for it. Now, this means that they have an inheritance tax liability, because the way inheritance tax works is a married couple or civil partners can give away up to £1 million tax-free, which consists of their individual nil rate bands, their individual IHT allowances, plus an extra allowance each for if they hand down their own home to a direct descendant, which is a child or a grandchild. And if you haven't used your inheritance tax allowance, you pass that on to your surviving spouse, who can then double it up, which is the scenario here. But that's £1 million. Above that, you'll be taxed 40%. This person has a £1.8 million house, so instantly has an inheritance tax liability. They have about £800,000 in savings and investments. They are also still working, having retired, and they set up their own business, and they make about £50,000 a year. And they said at the end of every month, they still have money left over. So they're saving into a combination of stocks and shares, ISAs, and cash, usually using their whole allowance each year. Now, so what's happening here is, rather than being in what is referred to in financial jargon as the decumulation phase, which is what happens when you retire and your income goes down, as we were talking about earlier on, about mortgages and stuff, and then you start spending your way through your pension, they are actually accumulating more money at the end of every month. And they have said that they would like to start giving some money away, as they realize a large chunk of their estate will end up facing inheritance tax. And having paid plenty of tax over their working life and still doing so now, they'd rather keep as much as possible for their children or their grandchildren and keep their future bill to a minimum. But they realised that due to the 7-year rule, they should have probably done something about this earlier. They said, I've gifted my children money to help them buy their homes in the past, but have been reluctant to just hand them large sums of cash beyond that without purpose. This is a massive concern for the generation who, you know, their estates will face inheritance tax. They want to pass on some money, but just giving people money is beset with problems. We don't really need to go into those. The problems of just giving people tens of thousands of pounds, we know exactly what they are, right? They said, my daughter has also told me that I should start spending more money on myself, flying business class, taking holidays, going for dinner, getting taxis, even paying for a big family holiday. But I also don't like wasting money, which is something that is generally true of people who have done quite well in life and managed to save up a lot of money, is they don't like wasting it either. So what can they do? Well, there's a number of things going on here. Firstly, the amount of money you can give away each year before it falling into the inheritance tax net is limited. You can only give away £3,000 per year, or you can give unlimited amounts of small gifts under £250, or you can give it for certain things like weddings and stuff like that. Those allowances haven't changed in years. They should change. There's been a big report into it. Government's done nothing. It's sat on its hands. The key exemption is this thing called the 7-year rule, which is if you give money away and you survive for another 7 years, it is out of the inheritance tax net. The only way to really deal with this is bluntly, if you are 77, your chances of surviving the next 7 years are lower than if you start doing this when you were much younger. Although I believe there is some kind of statistic that says if you make a certain age, you're then more likely to live longer. And I don't know what it is, so I'm not going to make it up. But hopefully this person is going to be very alive and healthy in another 7 years, in another 14 years, in another 21 years, maybe. So if they start giving money away now, then hopefully it will come out of the inheritance tax net. And actually, it's done on a sliding scale. It's not an all or nothing. It's not a, you give it away now, if you die within the next 7 years, it gets taxed. And if you die after the next 7 years, it gets taxed at nothing. It's on a sliding scale. So after, you know, 2 years, it starts to notch down. So that's worth doing. Also, they've got something called what is judged to be surplus income. And you are allowed to give away as much of that as you want, without it falling into the inheritance tax net, This is a bit complicated, though. You have to prove that you are not lowering your standard of living in any way, which if this person is accumulating more money at the end of every month, they would presumably be able to do. So that is an option. And the other thing they could do, as we said, is start spending more money on themselves. And both of the experts who answered this have said, look, you know, you've worked hard. Spend some money on yourself. Spend some money on your family. I know it sounds like you're wasting it, but, you know, enjoy yourself. And also, if you do spend it on things like a big family holiday or something like that, you're doing that, you know, you're creating enjoyable and memorable moments that people will hopefully have with them, you know, for the rest of their lives. I mean, if you do spend it on a big family holiday, you are also inevitably going to be creating some massive arguments, which people may also remember for the rest of their lives, thinking back to my big family holidays.
So that's the spirit.
Mainly, you remember the good stuff, not the bad stuff. And so anybody who's in this position, who may be listening to this, or whose parents are in this position, or whose grandparents are in this position, go and speak to that person and say, do you know what? Give it away. Give it to us if you want to. You know, not us, me, you and Ang, though we...
Yeah,
okay. May accept donations, but you know, give it away if you want to. But spend some money on yourself. Enjoy yourself. Go get that business class flight. Go on that holiday. Go stay in the nice hotel. You know, pay for the family holiday. It's obviously very easy to go tell people to pay for a family holiday if you're going to benefit from it. But yeah, there is an argument that, you know, people should be doing more of this.
I think so. Absolutely right. Right. Finally, fraudsters are brazenly advertising fake banknotes on social media sites, including Facebook, Instagram and X, for a fraction of the face value. The major currency firm is warning that the scammers are targeting the most vulnerable, even offering bulk buy discounts for fake cash. The adverts claim that the counterfeit money is realistic enough to pass security checks. But who, Ang, would buy cash on social media?
It's hard to know, really. I think most people would probably steer clear, but when you're kind of strapped for cash, it might be tempting. So we had some research from the travel money firm Number One Currency, which showed that criminals are advertising fake banknotes on social media. So they are all over Facebook, Instagram, X. And as you say, they are offering kind of free postage, discounts on these counterfeit notes. One example was someone selling £14,000 of fake banknotes for £1,200. And that kind of slowly went up. And, you know, they claim that they pass all the security checks. So for, you know, people that maybe are worried about money at the moment, maybe they're going on holiday, I can see how it could potentially be tempting. Obviously, if they were that good, they'd be using them and not selling them. But it seems like it's a growing issue. I had a look myself. It's all over Facebook. One account was posting since February. It's not been taken down. It's every kind of few days. So it seems to be a real issue. So the research that this firm did for us, they found that the scammers are paying for posts to appear on the timelines of the most vulnerable people because of the way cookies work and adverts tailored to you and put on your feed. So those struggling financially are more likely to see those posts than maybe other people.
Do you get the cash? I mean, or is it just total scam? There's nothing there that they're going to give to you. And I say cash, I mean counterfeit pieces of paper that look like allegedly money.
I think that some do send it, but it's obviously completely fake. And if you go and try and use it, the shop or bank will confiscate it and they will go to the police. Others will just say, you know, we're sending it out, and then they never do. So it's either a scam or completely criminal.
And it's not just the counterfeit cash. It's all sorts of issues we hear about big social media sites. If you cannot police your site, then don't be so big. Do you know what I mean? I can't work out how this stuff is still allowed to kind of proliferate on these sites.
It's so frustrating. It feels like every week we are writing a story about a new scam that has cropped up on Facebook or Instagram or X or wherever. And it's been going on for so long. I think, you know, with X, we know the issues there, but Facebook get constantly called out, whether it's because of Facebook Marketplace or dodgy adverts. You know, a lot of investment scams start there and nothing is done about it. I did ask Meta about this, the counterfeit note thing, and they said, you know, fraudulent activity isn't allowed. We remove the content, but they haven't removed the content because the content is still up there. I can see it. It's still there today. And I don't know what it will take for them to do something other than, you know, hit them where it hurts, start finding them proper sums of money, percentage of revenue or something like that, because it feels like, you know, they can take down posts 2 months after the fact, but it's already, you know, they're already victims. It's just at that point.
I won't hold my breath, Aang, sorry. But Simon, your views?
Well, I think that's a really good point that Aang made, that you can take down this post after the event, but it's too late. People have seen it. People have replied to it. People have got ripped off. I can see what people are doing here if they're tempted. They think, well, clearly this money is dodgy. But I might not get caught. You know, if I can get 14 grand for £1,200, that's a nice little earner. And maybe no one will notice. Maybe I'll be able to spend it. They don't really think through that actually if I get caught trying to spend counterfeit money and it turns out that I know that I bought counterfeit money, I might get in quite a lot of trouble. And the people end up being untraceable. I think what's really concerning is the fact that these adverts are up there on social media. And literally, what could be more dodgy than an advert offering to sell you money for less than the money is worth? That I don't think anything could possibly be more obviously a scam, stroke illegal, and should not be appearing on social media platforms. And what should definitely not be happening is the fraudsters should not be able to take advantage of the social media platforms' advertising algorithms in order to target the people most likely to be daft enough to go and buy fake cash off somebody on social media. So I think there's any number of things that are wrong here, and it really just needs to stop.
Aang, any tips on how to spot fake cash?
Yeah, I mean, if they're, as Simon says, if they're selling for less than they're worth, I think that's a pretty big red flag. And I mean, anything, if you're buying anything on social media, you kind of need to take it with a pinch of salt. One of the things that the travel firm flagged was, I think lots of people think that fake banknotes tend to be kind of higher denominations, so the kind of £50. Actually, they tend to go for 10 and 20s. They're also doing euro notes as well. Simple things, checking for spelling mistakes, faded colours, checking holograms, that sort of thing. But I think the general rule is if you're not sure, just don't risk it.
Quite. All right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, stick podcast in the subject line, or you can tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like a podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.